Today at Reader's Corner, John Ray, author of Godsend. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Personal stories of lives affected by terrorism have been the well-trod terrain of many books, films, and television. More recently, a new crop of journalists and writers have attempted to shed light on the question plaguing many in the international community. Who are these young men and women leaving home to join ISIS, the Taliban, and other terrorist groups? John Ray's Godsend is a diligent and eloquent attempt to fill out that portrait. Inspired by the story of John Walker Lind, the so-called American Taliban, Godsend is the story of Aiden Sawyer, desperate to escape the confines of her hometown and defying her domineering parents. Aiden travels to Pakistan and Afghanistan, entangling herself in a web of radicalization, violence, and disillusionment about her original purpose. John Ray is the author of the critically acclaimed novels The Lost Time Accidents, Low Boy, The Right Hand of Sleep, and Canaan's Tongue. The recipient of a Whiting Writers Award, he was named one of Granta's Best of Young American Novelists in 2007. John Ray, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
John, could we start by your refreshing our memory on John Walker Lind?
Absolutely. John Walker Lind was a kid from Northern California, grew up in sort of upper middle class circumstances, well-educated parents. His mother was a church-going Christian woman. And he, in the last few years of the 20th century, and especially 1999 and 2000, became more and more interested in Islam, eventually converting to that religion and studying Arabic. He went to Pakistan to study the Quran at a madrasa, which is essentially a school where the students live. It's almost like a boarding school dedicated to the study of the holy book of Islam, of the Quran, essentially dedicated to learning it by heart. While there, he fell in with some people who gradually radicalized him and awakened his interest in politics, essentially. And with these people, he eventually crossed the border into Afghanistan in the year 2000 and came to serve as essentially a regular soldier, an infantryman in the army of the Taliban, who were fighting various warlords in the northern part of their country. This was right before 9/11. Then 9/11 happened, and suddenly John Walker Lind went from being an American kid, 18 years old, who had made the somewhat questionable decision to fight in a foreign army, to suddenly being essentially number one on America's list of suspected terrorists after his capture. Afghanistan became America's sort of number one enemy internationally for a brief period, and John Walker Lind found himself caught up in that conflict, which was something that he had, of course, never anticipated, in the same way that none of us could have anticipated 9/11 or its consequences.
It's an amazing story, and I understand, and I wouldn't have known this if I didn't look this up after reading your book, that he's going to get out May of 2019, 20 years in prison?
He was sentenced on various counts and has been in prison since shortly after 9/11, and theoretically, he'll be getting out in May. Some of us are a little bit skeptical, you know, but in the current political climate, you know, there's no political gain to be had from letting John Walker Lind out. So we'll have to see how the politicians handle that. I'm hopeful that he'll get out. I mean, I think he's more than served his time, considering that he wasn't actually ever convicted of anything related to terrorism. He was just in the wrong army at the wrong time.
So it sure looks like Aiden, the protagonist in your novel, is modeled after John Walker Lind. And one of the things we find out about Aiden, right about the time she is given the news that 9/11 has occurred, and I hope to have some time later in this interview to talk a little bit about that, she talks about the fact that she joined, in one sense, to prepare for a military campaign against the Northern Alliance. And I guess I need a little help with the politics of Afghanistan and Iraq. And
sure,
whether it's John Walker Lind or whether it's Aiden, are these young people going to fight against the United States, or do they think they're fighting against some foreign entity that is doing harm to Islam and to the true army of Islam?
Well, In fact, the whole concept of a Northern Alliance didn't exist until the United States went to war with the Taliban after 9/11. What we eventually came to refer to as the Northern Alliance before the United States' involvement in Afghanistan was no alliance at all. It was essentially a number of distinct warlords and their respective armies who were on the defensive at that point against the Taliban. And without going into too much history about the Taliban, originally the Taliban, which is actually just means students, was a movement, a grassroots movement that began as an attempt to liberate post-war Afghanistan from the stranglehold of various warlords and their armies who had formerly been Mujahideen, who had been fighting the Soviets. And these were groups of people who were funded and armed to a large degree by the United States and by Europe in the attempt to liberate Afghanistan from Soviet control, which, of course, is a laudable cause and one that was obviously very interesting to the United States because of our relationship with the Soviet Union at the time. But these people, as so often happens, once the war against the Soviet Union was over, these were people who had enjoyed tremendous power in the course of that war and really knew how to do nothing but fight. And after that war was finished, many of them gradually became essentially, I mean, a sort of mafia developed essentially, in which the country of Afghanistan was carved up into these territories controlled by these various warlords who were not particularly, well, how should I put this? These were not particularly kind or ethical or in any way religious men. They were just carving up the country in a sort of feudal way. And a lot of kind of normal people in Afghanistan really felt a squeeze. I mean, they would set up these roadblocks where no matter who you were, if you wanted to travel on that road, you had to pay these extortionary fees to whichever warlord was in charge of the territory. And this eventually became impossible. It was really threatening to cause a breakdown of the entire economic system in Afghanistan. And as a result, this kind of spontaneous movement to resist these very unscrupulous warlords began. And since there were no leaders who could really be relied on to take up so risky an endeavor, people went to the local religious leaders. They went to the leaders of local madrasas, for example, which is how the movement came to be called simply the students, which is what Taliban means. And in the initial weeks or months of that movement, it was actually, you know, something that I feel like most of us could theoretically have gotten behind, you know, a grassroots uprising against some pretty severe oppression on the part of more or less regular people. That changed very quickly, of course. And as the movement gained in power, they had a lot of early successes against these warlords and had an enormous amount of popular support among the common people in Afghanistan. But as their movement accrued power and as essentially fundamentalist ideologues seized control of the whole notion of what the Taliban movement could be, it became far more sinister very, very quickly.
And that's what Aidan Sawyer discovers in her
she does.
Travels there.
She does. But like John Walker Lind, when she first crosses the border into Afghanistan, she thinks she's doing so to lend her support to what is essentially a grassroots movement by the people of Afghanistan to liberate themselves from some pretty severe oppression. And of course, to create this kind of ideal religious state in which everyone will behave in a moral way and take care of one another. I mean, it's essentially a religious utopia. You know, it's a concept that is not specific to Islam in any way. It's something that we could often see if we were to look at the early history of the United States, for example. So her motivations are actually very, very commendable in the same way that John Walker Lind's were when he first went over there. I mean, he was a very ignorant young man. He thought he knew far more than he actually did about the country he was choosing to serve. He had a very, very rude awakening, obviously, and it turned out to be a very, very dangerous and frightening experience for Aidan herself in the novel.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is John Ray, author of Godsend. So you decided, I think you might have been working on a story for Esquire. So you go over to Pakistan and Afghanistan to learn more. Tell us about going over there, what you did. I understand from reading your background, you dressed up as a Talib. with full beard, blend in with the locals, and in many ways succeeded at mastering Islam. You're credited that by some of your reviewers on this novel. What happened over there for you?
Oh, a lot of stuff happened. It was an unforgettable time that I spent in Afghanistan. I arrived there on assignment for Esquire magazine in the hope of writing an article about the family of one particular warlord named Dostum, D-O-S-T-U-M, who was one of the more important allies of the United States in our conflict with the Taliban. Yeah, to travel around the country to get to the places that I wanted to go, to which I was taken by someone who worked as my fixer, which basically just means someone who takes foreign journalists or political operatives around in a hazardous or difficult region. I had this wonderful guy whose name I can't divulge, but he was a member of the Hazara minority in Afghanistan, the only Shia Muslim group in a country that's otherwise Sunni. So they sort of have to learn how to survive in a more or less hostile environment. And that makes them wonderful interpreters and guides and bodyguards and just general sort of lifesavers to people like me who don't quite know maybe exactly what they're getting into before they arrive. But I learned in a hurry.
So I'm going to ask you to tell one story about how you learned something regarding the local culture that you didn't quite understand. I think going over a mountain and was a long way from a restroom or anything that would look like an American restroom. Please pass along that experience for us.
Yeah, I think this was after spending some time in Kabul with my fixer, who was kind of showing me around, slowly teaching me how to behave, how to eat, how to dress, of course, how to walk, how to behave in this culture that I had read a great deal about but never actually visited. Eventually, he decided that maybe we were ready to take our first field trip. So we headed from Kabul to the Khyber Pass, essentially, to this point of entry into Afghanistan called Torkham. And in order to get there, we were traveling through some territories that were firmly in the hands of the federal government of Afghanistan during daylight hours, but became Taliban territory as soon as the sun went down. And this was a pretty stable situation. You know, it was well understood that if you could, you know, you could travel through these areas as long as the sun was up, but you didn't want the sun to go down on you in these regions. So we had to travel through some of them in this beat up little Toyota Corolla that my fixer drives as part of his mantra, which is low profile, low profile, low profile. It's how he stays alive and keeps his clients alive. Things were going very well, at least when I was seated inside the car with my, you know, the beard that I'd grown and the way I was dressed. There actually are quite a few fair-haired people in Afghanistan, supposedly relics of Alexander the Great's armies. So I didn't really stand out at all. At some point, about halfway through the trip, it was about a three-hour drive, as I remember, I started to feel the call of nature, and I asked if we could pull over. And my fixer pulled the car over by the side of the road, this kind of broader shoulder where a number of people were stopped for the very same reason. You know, it was, you know, not that different from these sort of roadside spots in the United States where people obviously are pulling over to take care of one thing and one thing only. And I got out of the car, went over to the side of the road, you know, just sort of approached the whole operation the way I would anywhere else in the world. And suddenly I heard a sort of shout behind me, and my fixer had jumped out of the car and was running towards me, sort of waving his hands as though, you know, I had a stick of dynamite in my hand or something. I didn't know what was going on. I realized that the other men who had pulled over and were going to the bathroom in that place were all squatting on the ground, exactly the way you would if you had something more serious to take care of than simply urinating. And I was the only one who was standing up. There was a row of us. Everyone else was squatting. And I was standing up, you know, the way one would in the U.S. And, of course, everyone was staring at me because that's just not done in Afghanistan. That's not how you do it there. So I had completely blown my cover, you know, doing something that I thought was pretty universal worldwide. But it turns out that you should never make assumptions about anything being universal because the local customs will surprise you.
So how did an Esquire article turn into a novel? What happened along the way that got you on to Aidan Sawyer and Suleiman, as she was called in disguise?
Really, it was a series of setbacks. You know, I think as so often happens, things that we perceive as strokes of misfortune or just as flat-out failures can kind of bump us in a direction we might never otherwise have chosen or even discovered. And in this case, I arrived in Afghanistan essentially a week after President Obama had sort of declared mission accomplished there and had officially said that all American troops were to be withdrawn effective immediately. So, you know, there was this little lull. There was this hope that there would be this calm before the storm. Everyone seemed to know that the center would not hold in Afghanistan and that sooner or later the Taliban would kind of reawaken and start making inroads into territory they'd lost. So there was hope that I could get to certain parts of the country and talk to various people who were affiliated with the warlord whose family I was writing about. But unfortunately, conditions changed so quickly that we were just cut off and couldn't get to certain parts of the country that we wanted to. So that was very frustrating for me, obviously. I was there to write an article, and it seemed as though I was not going to physically be able to do so. At the same time, I had become interested in the story of John Walker Lind over the preceding year or two, and had also been considering working on some sort of nonfiction project, maybe even a whole book about John Walker Lind, which is something I still would urge the writers out there to consider doing, because I know of no more emblematic story of the kind of complicated and tragic nature of our war on terror over the last 20 years than his personal story. So I began, since I couldn't reach the people I was supposed to reach, I started interviewing people about John Walker Lind and trying to find people who had known him or, you know, at least heard of his story, which has become something of a legend in Afghanistan over the years. We made a little headway with that. And one day we were in a village a little bit north of Kabul, and I was speaking to an old man who was, we just saw by chance, he was sort of sitting on this sun-warmed kind of brick wall at the edge of town and smoking a cigarette. And I asked him, have you heard about the American boy? Have you heard about John Walker Lind, who was also called Suleiman when he was in the army of the Taliban? Many people who came to volunteer first in the jihad against the Soviets and then later in the conflict with the Northern Alliance took on new names, becoming part of the conflict. You basically took on a sort of nom de guerre, I guess would be exactly what you'd call it. So John Walker Lind, as well as the heroine of my novel, both take the name Suleiman. So I was asking this old man about that, and he said, "Oh, of course, I know about the American boy. I know all about the American boy. I know about the boy, but I also know about the girl." So I was immediately fascinated by that, because after spending some time in Afghanistan, the idea that any foreigner, let alone a girl, could have found some way to cross that border and to take part in that conflict, it just astonished me completely. And we did our best to find out more about her from that old man. He had some information. He claimed she was American. He claimed she'd come across the border from Pakistan, similar to the way John Walker Lind did. He didn't have that much more information about her, and sometimes his information was a little contradictory. And so then we set about trying to find other people who had heard about this possibly apocryphal, legendary girl who had somehow aided in the fight. We managed to here and there pick up little traces and bits of information that was unfortunately, again, often contradictory. It was kind of like interviewing six people who are witnesses to a car accident. You start to have to try to fight your way through all these contradictions and vague scraps of information. And we gave it our best shot over the course of a number of weeks. Eventually, we sort of had to concede defeat. It didn't seem to me that in the few weeks remaining to me, or really, I think it may have been days at that point, that I was ever going to make enough headway to even write an article for a magazine, let alone an entire nonfiction book. And that's when it suddenly hit me that I'm really a novelist. I'm not a nonfiction writer. I mean, I do work as a journalist occasionally, but what I really do is write novels. And I hadn't thought of it in those terms at all up until that point, oddly enough, maybe because the reality was just so compelling. But as soon as I had that kind of eureka moment and realized that this didn't have to be an article for Esquire magazine or an exhaustively researched 800 page on this mysterious person, but could in fact be a novel, and that the gaps in what we knew or the contradictions in the accounts that we'd received of this mysterious girl could in fact be an advantage. They could be the place where the fictional story could grow, where the novel could sort of take form.
Well, it certainly did. There's no question about that. I've never been anywhere near a madrasa, but your description of the experience seems spot on, not only according to me and how would I know, but to reviewers who sounded like they did know. How close did you get to a madrasa to be able to recreate this incredible atmosphere and informed view of what life would be like in a madrasa?
Well, you know, madrasas, like mosques, are in fact very inviting places to strangers, as long as those strangers are respectful and, you know, have a kind of even just a vague sense of how to behave. You know, you don't want to walk in the middle of a mosque with your dirty shoes on from the street. But if you show a reasonable amount of respect for the place and for the people who are engaged in worship there, you'll be welcomed. I mean, it's not that different from a stranger stepping into a church somewhere in central Kansas or something, you know? Mm-hmm. People might wonder who you are, but they're not going to kick you out as long as you behave yourself. So I was able to get, during my time there, and also after I returned to the United States, of course, you know, we have mosques here, and it's a thriving culture in the U.S. as well. I really just found that if I showed respect, I was welcomed, and people were also open to talking to me about their faith and about their culture. I mean, people were only too eager to talk to me about these things because they were hoping to do their part to correct all of the misunderstandings and misrepresentations that culture has really had to suffer here in the U.S., you know? I mean, the way people talk about Islam in this country, you know, it's as though someone were to say all Christians are ignorant thieves and murderers because there were a handful of troubled people who were members of some congregation in some rural place who were involved in some sort of crime. I'm in no way sympathetic to people who take up arms in the service of any kind of ideology whatsoever. And certainly I would include Islam in that. But at the same time, that's just such a tiny little fragment of the picture. And we're talking about a culture of billions of people on the planet that contains a great amount of beauty and that is actually fundamentally, ethically, and morally quite beautiful.
I'm Bob Kustra. Today I'm speaking with John Ray, author of Godsend. The novel is inspired by the story of John Walker Lind, the so-called American Taliban. We always spare our listeners the ending of a novel. This is too good of a read and a narrative to spoil the ending for our listeners. But I would like you to at least give the listeners a brief account of Aidan Sawyer, especially the part about posing as a young boy. I assume that has something to do with how easy it is to get into a madrasa as a boy and not a girl. But why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, there are many, many things, of course. The thing about Aidan Sawyer is that she does not only leave Northern California to explore the Islamic world and to educate herself about its religion and its culture, but she goes to essentially the most fundamentalist region in the entire Islamic world. I mean, the so-called tribal regions along the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan are a very, very forbidding place in which a very, very strict and fundamentalist version of Islam is practiced. It's also the region where it was believed for, you know, all those years that Osama bin Laden might be hiding, because it was one of the few places, I think, that the Pentagon could imagine a person could conceivably hide themselves effectively in the modern world. So a very, very remote place, a very warlike place, a very forbidding place. And there's just simply no way for a woman, let alone a girl of 18 years old, to travel there, let alone study the Quran there, without some kind of disguise being called for. So Aidan travels there with a friend of hers, a kid of Islamic background, of Pakistani background from California, and they hatch this kind of harebrained scheme, as a couple of teenagers will, of disguising Aidan as a boy of her choosing to call herself Suleiman and really posing as a 12-year-old boy who, you know, doesn't have facial hair yet and all these things. So her friend, whose name is Decker, assists her in this, and they travel together to Pakistan. They find a madrasa that will take them. They begin to study the Quran, and it turns out to be quite a beautiful time for them. But that doesn't last very long. And her friend Decker, who's just kind of a more or less red-blooded American kid who kind of has some pretty naive ideas about adventure, starts to be more and more interested in the war that's happening very close by, right across the border in Afghanistan. And eventually he's essentially seduced into military service in that war by a couple charismatic figures who pass through the madrasa looking for recruits. Aiden eventually decides to follow her friend to Afghanistan, as much to try to save him from his own folly as for any other reason. But she finds herself caught up in the conflict there as well, and things become pretty hairy for her from that point on. Her identity is at risk of being discovered, and while she's in Afghanistan, the attacks of the 11th of September occur, which change everything, of course. And really then she's essentially just trying to survive.
The New Yorker magazine called your novel a 9/11 novel that finally understands the fulfillment of faith. And another reviewer said that you had created the first real 9/11 novel. Did that occur to you as you were writing it? Or as I've talked with a number of writers, sometimes they're always surprised to hear what other people think of their work because it hadn't occurred to them.
Yeah, it's always surprising. I mean, and the good stuff is usually more surprising than the bad stuff. You know, I think most writers are neurotics and we tend to be pretty hard on ourselves. And when people take the stuffing out of us, it hurts, but we're not always necessarily surprised. Maybe we think we deserve it. But when you hear really good stuff, when your book gets real praise, especially on, you know, on the kind of level you're talking about, it is pretty surprising. I can't say it's not a bit of a shock. I mean, I was living in New York City when 9/11 happened. I saw the towers fall from the roof of the house that I was living in. It's been something that's been etched into my brain and sort of my guts ever since then. That doesn't mean that I ever intended to write about it. It certainly wasn't something that I told myself I had to somehow address in any kind of writing, fiction or nonfiction. I don't tend to write about my own life very much. And, you know, 9/11 was one of these topics that I almost had too much respect for to just try and stuff it in some novel or other just to be relevant or something. It just wasn't something I was interested in doing. And when I began Godsend, I wasn't necessarily thinking about 9/11 that much either. It kind of happened in the course of the writing process that I realized it would cast a shadow over the book, of course, but it happened in the way that the attacks themselves happened, you know, almost out of a clear blue sky. And then, of course, at some point I realized that I couldn't write this book without addressing 9/11 in some way, because it changed the world, and obviously particularly that part of the world. Mm-hmm. But 9/11 isn't really front and center in my book. It's sort of something that happens at a distance and then yields terrible consequences. So it's really 9/11 from the opposite standpoint or viewpoint to ours here in the United States. I actually think that this kind of reverse end of the telescope approach to 9/11 was what made me able to write about it in maybe a fresh way, because I wasn't writing about it from the point of view of people in New York City, and I wasn't writing about it from the point of view of, I don't know, the terrorists in the airplanes. I was writing about it from the point of view of people in a very remote part of the world who think they have nothing to do with the United States, let alone with Al-Qaeda or anything like that. And then they find out, to their own amazement and to their great sorrow, that in fact they had a lot to do with it and that the entire world was involved in what happened that day.
Well, you've certainly succeeded at that, John. Again, I want to remind our listeners, we're talking with John Ray about his novel Godsend, and I strongly recommend the book. It's not only a great narrative, but there's a number of teaching moments in it as well, and I thank you very much for writing the book and joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.